This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Liam Fox and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. We'll take a look at the big stories from the region over the past week. Coming up, concerns in Cook Islands as water supplies run low amid dry weather. Businesses and students in Timor-Leste frustrated by very, very slow internet speeds. And family, faith and footy. A film about the emotional journey of Pacifica rugby players who've finally been able to play for their countries of heritage. We'll have more on those stories coming up. First, in Papua New Guinea, a young boy has drowned during coastal flooding that's devastated islands in the country's far northeast. A combination of heavy rain and high tides has left homes, roads and cemeteries in coastal areas of New Island province badly damaged. Local authorities have told reporter Tekla Gunga they've never seen anything like it.
This is the sound of a massive king tide that swallowed homes in New Island province. Coastal villages had already been dealing with weeks of rains, but the tides this week have flooded communities. Since these enormous waves began hitting the province, one death has been reported. Terence Tassia from New Island's disaster office said he's still getting a full picture from ward councillors before putting together a budget to seek assistance for affected communities.
We already have one report of one death, an 8-year-old boy. He drowned on Monday. That was soon after we pushed out a notice to stop small craft from operating, and I went to NBC and advised people not to go fishing, not to go diving. In the afternoon, the next day, we had a report, confirmed report of one 8-year-old male drowned in Putput.
Videos and images posted on social media by community leader Lamilat Pamut show the strength of the high tides sweeping through homes. Properties that were at least 20 meters away from the shoreline were hit. The coastal flooding has destroyed several homes and cemeteries on the Taba group of islands and forced people to move to higher grounds.
This is probably the first time I've witnessed in a long time, and I'm over 60 years old now, and I've never seen something like this where one day of it pounded the entire coast and villages around my area. The high waves, it was quite serious.
Mr. Tassia says parts of the Buluminsky Highway has been cut off.
There's a majority of houses and only Solorai washed them away. Debris on the roadside. There are certain points along the highway where culverts are. There's signs of weakness in structure, the road there. The water just washed in and now the road network is not stable.
PNG's capital and many other provinces are also being hit by wild weather. The National Weather Office says a monsoon trough line is extending from the coast of Western Province right through Gulf, NCD and Central Provinces to Milne Bay. Residents are being told to expect continuous rains and flooding, while coastal areas will be experiencing strong winds.
Tekla Gunga reporting. Still on the subject of the weather, and a lack of rain in parts of Cook Islands is prompting calls for locals on Rarotonga to conserve water, with reservoirs getting extremely low. Forecasters put the dried conditions down to the El Niño weather system. Some people are worried about what could happen if rain does not fall soon. Dubrovka Volodare has the story.
For months now, Mary McDonald has been dreaming of hearing the drum of raindrops on her roof. Living inland and on higher ground, the Rarotonga resident has seen little rain over the past months.
It has been raining, but it's not quite a heavy rain.
This dry spell is affecting the island's water sources.
You know, we've had rain here and there, but not enough to recharge all our mountain streams and groundwater.
The spokesperson for the Rarotonga-based water authority, Our Water, is Walter Tuarae.
It causes a fair bit of stress with our water supply here, yeah, because it's totally reliant on rain, unfortunately.
In the southern island group, which includes Rarotonga, water is sourced from springs and streams that rely on rainwater.
We have 10 intakes here, 10 mountain streams that feed the island. Currently, we're probably producing about 60% of its capacity.
Mr. Tuarae says the higher-lying inland parts of the island, where Mary lives, have been hit hardest by the low rainfall levels.
With our system being gravity-fed and with the terrain of Rarotonga, meaning quite a very highly mountainous interior, when we do have a lot of rain and abundance of water, you get enough back pressure in the network to push water back up to our inner ring main. So unfortunately for those people living in our inland districts, they tend to be without water in most periods of the day. Those are sort of like, you know, high elevations, but they definitely can't get water up there. There's just not enough pressure in the actual system to get up there.
Mary built big water tanks to collect water for the rainy season. While she has enough of her own water for now, the lack of rain has forced her to ration out what is left.
We tend to conserve water now. Less washing, I suppose. Yeah, turn taps off, not running while you're brushing your teeth. Yeah, things like that.
Many others in her close neighbourhood are not so lucky.
I see them buying water, so they're actually don't have enough. Water tanks? Not as big as ours anyway.
Mr. Tuarae says while residents in these inland areas are the worst affected, all Rarotongans are hit to some degree. And he says, like Mary, they can do a lot to save water.
Definitely conserve water. You know, fix their leaks around their houses, pleading to the growers and people like that to shut off the irrigation taps and hoses and things like that. Leakage is probably the biggest cause of our concern. You know, washing your dishes in the actual sink and perhaps washing it in the tub, things like that, and making sure you're, you know, filling your washing machine up before you actually do a wash.
Tourists are also encouraged to help by having shorter showers and being mindful about their water consumption. Meteorologist Neville Koop from Nandraki Weather says El Nino is to blame for some of the dry spell in parts of the Pacific, including the Southern Cooks.
Typically with El Nino, the dry conditions generally stay in the west of the Pacific and in the south of the Pacific. And so places like Nauru and Kiribati and the eastern islands of Kiribati around Christmas Island and so forth, Penrhyn, Northern Cooks, those sort of places have had some good rain. The Southern Cooks, Niue and parts of Tonga have experienced dry weather, as has New Caledonia.
Mr. Koop says what's unusual this year is that Australia's east coast, which should have also had dry conditions, has had a lot of rainfall.
This is not the type of El Nino that we would normally see, I have to say. There is some unusual aspects to this, whether that is climate change influence or whether that's just natural variability, I really couldn't say.
But there might be some respite in sight. He says for Cook Islands' southern islands, some rain might be falling in a few weeks' time. For residents like Mary, it couldn't come soon enough.
Yeah, every drop counts, really.
Mary McDonald ending that report by Dubrovka Volodare. Timor-Leste is a young nation, not only the country itself, but its population, with an average age of just 20. They're becoming increasingly digitally savvy, with more people relying on the internet to conduct business or study. But internet speeds are slow, among the slowest in the world, and there's frustration at the patchy service and high cost. In Dili, our Timor-Leste reporter Vonya Vieira has the story.
In Timor-Leste, the internet is stuck in other era. Sometimes we can't connect to the WhatsApp, or even we want to send some file or picture. It's like very late to send to others.
Betilia Leko Loko is a student at the University of Timor-Leste in Dili. She uses the internet every day to find reference and do school assignment. But there is a problem.
It is very poor because sometimes the internet speeds be like 1 or 10 or 2, 3 kilobyte per second. Like, it's very low speed limit because it's really difficult us to do the research or connect to the internet.
Timor-Leste has a population of 1.3 million, with just under half considered active internet user. The population is also very young, with the average age about 20, and the country is modernizing rapidly, meaning more and more people are becoming digital savvy, relying on the internet to conduct business or study. But the pace of the infrastructure to support this evolution is not keeping up. In fact, it is so slow that according to research by UK broadband operator Cable, Timor-Leste has the fourth slowest internet speed in the world, behind Afghanistan, Syria, and Yemen. 20-year-old Ovidio da Costa Verdial, a student at Dili Institute of Technology, like Betilia, he can perform the simplest tasks.
Sometimes I cannot open my email, and then sometimes I cannot open the Google because the internet very slowly. And also, one important thing that I usually do is I always watching the news, and then I enter to YouTube, and I can open the speed so very slowly.
And then there is the cost at the price of $1 per day. It is unaffordable for most students.
The cost is so very high because it's $1. So if we spend $1 a day as a student, we get very poorly.
The slow speeds are not just a problem for students. Joaquin Fonseca, daily life depends on the internet. As an IT professional, often he simply cannot do his job. He uses all three of Timor-Leste service providers in order to try and find a good signal.
Some are better than others in different places, but in general, I have to say that they fall short of providing the much required, the much needed service for few people who would like to work fast. It's really frustrating because it is not only about the cost. It is just the inconsistency.
For Joaquim, the solution is a simple.
Fiber optic is a very, very high quality infrastructure. But do they have the infrastructure which can match the speed which can be provided by facilities such as fiber optics?
If all goes to plan, soon Joaquim's prayers will be answered. The current government, led by Xanana Gusmão, says it is committed to establish cross-border terrestrial fiber optic cable system through the construction of the Timor-Leste sub-submarine cable system. This project was implemented by the previous government and part-funded by Australia, aims to connect Timor-Leste to the internet via Australia. It is due to be completed by the end of this year. For Dedi Etuar Ambarita, it is long overdue. Dedi is the vice president for finance and business partner of Telkomsel, one of Timor-Leste three internet provider. He admits internet speeds in the country are not good enough, but he says the introduction of fiber optic cables in Timor, as well as better regulation and support from government, will change everything.
We try to propose since 2 years ago fiber optic for international gateway. We also try to anticipate the modernization of network, and also if we can get the license, so the internet will getting better.
For Fernando Ximenez, improving the internet is integral to improving quality of life in the country. Fernando has conducted research into the political economy of telecommunication in Timor-Leste. He says telco companies are trying to monopolize internet price, but they forget it is everyone's right to access the internet with good quality.
So far, there's no blocking, there's no censorship, but there is also a question of economic rights. That is right of access and quality.
According to Fernando, the telcos as well as government needs to do better as they were focusing on how to make money rather than serving the people.
In some particular areas in Dili, especially in improvised area, marginal areas, the internet connections are very poor and very bad. There is a huge of what we can call the digital segregation or digital inequality in terms of access.
Researcher Fernando Ximenez ending that report from Vonya Vieira. Finally, the battle for Pacifica rugby players to win the right to play for their countries of heritage has been long and hard. But that changed at the Men's World Cup in France last year when Samoa, Tonga and Fiji fielded a host of top-class players who made the switch after having played for Australia and New Zealand. The journeys of some of those players, notably Tonga's Big Two, Malachi Fekitoa and Charles Piotau, the million-pound man based in England, were captured by a documentary crew. The results was Family, Faith and Footy, a film which producer Jeremiah Tawamiti tells Richard Hewitt was designed to let the players tell their stories in an open, honest and sometimes heart-rending way.
We are just weeks away from the start of the 2023 Rugby World Cup. And as they make their final preparations, the Pacifica teams are more of a threat than ever. Historically, the island nations have been under-resourced, undermanned and overlooked. But now, Tonga's Ikaletahi is stacked with more world-class internationals than ever before. It's a huge moment for the likes of former All Blacks Malachi Fekitoa and Charles Piotau. Until now, the chances of these marquee stars playing for their island nation was little more than a dream.
You've got to show what it means. No fear. That's the difference of us. We're willing to die for our country.
Could this finally be a new chapter in the story of Pacifica rugby?
Having Malachi and Charles Piotau, especially the two sort of drivers of the documentary, having their family members being open and honest as well, and being able to speak to the people that mean so much to us, which is often the mother and our families, being able to listen to them, which is, you know, a perspective that you hardly ever hear from, especially given that English is their second language. And so another part of the documentary was if we wanted family members to be open and honest, then the interviews had to be conducted in, for example, the Tongan language. And I don't think it matters if you don't speak Tongan. I think when you watch the documentary, you definitely get a sense of, I guess, some of the heartbreak that their family members have had to go through. And but also, which was the most important for us, the joy that they've felt seeing their sons go through the journey that they have and being able to give back to their family as well. So, yeah, it was pretty humbling to be in that position to hear what you don't often get to hear.
All of us from the islands, we don't just play for ourselves, you know. And ever since I grew up, it's always been for my parents, you know. I've never seen my mum so happy and proud. And she went through a lot with losing our dad. It was hard because he's not around to... You know, he's not around to live it through with me, you know what I mean? And to experience these experiences I'm having, you know?
In the case of Malachi Fekitoa, the emotion that comes through from him is, to my ears, quite extraordinary. And one of the things that I think it tells me is how painful it was for him to wait as long as he had to wait before he could actually honour his family and play for his country of heritage. He waited a long, long time before the rules were changed. You get that sense that he thought it would never happen.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, it was the same for Charles as well. Like, there were the actual legal loopholes that they had to go through in order to represent their country. And I think a lot of people make the mistake of, you know, if you play for one country, then that should be it. And if you play for another one, then that means your loyalty to maybe Australia or New Zealand, the system that you've gone through. Some people, I think they see it as if they're disloyal. But at the end of the day, these guys are rugby players and it's their main source of income. But it is possible to love Australia and New Zealand and your country of heritage. They were brought up with values that enabled them to make the best of the systems in New Zealand and Australia. So they feel torn. A lot of players overseas aren't able to play for Tonga or Fiji or Samoa. I think for me personally, it's sad that some clubs feel as if they have to make it harder for the boys to play for their home countries. You know, financially, all the players that play for Fiji, Tonga and Samoa, they all take a big financial hit when they do it. But I think that shows you the extent, because for them, playing for Samoa or Tonga or Fiji means playing for their family. And for me, that's probably one of the most honourable things that they can do. Yeah, Molokai and Charles have been through a lot, but we've got to remember too, there is just a small sample of what all these boys have to go through.
There's always the pressure being a marquee signing and the expectations that come with it to deliver. You need to always perform at a certain level. Like, you know, we're paying you all this money, it's expected, like you should be. And when you're not getting it done, then it's like, wow, man, that weight can weigh you down. And church and my faith, I think that's really helped me be rooted and not let that get to your head.
Now, the film was produced in and around the World Cup, and clearly Charles, Molokai and others who had opted to play for their countries of heritage in that tournament went in with high hopes of making a difference. And I think the harsh reality for Tonga was, despite the fact that they had a significant number of players who made the switch, they couldn't create that team, could they? They couldn't bring that team together in the way that they needed to do to take on three of the top four teams in the world, as it was in their pool. So I guess that must have been a disappointment for them, that they had the joy of playing in the colours, but they couldn't quite deliver, I suspect, what they hoped they would deliver.
They don't hide it. They're disappointed. But I also feel as if they don't have anywhere near as much time as the other teams together. We were shooting and there were a handful, maybe five or so players on the week of the game that were still arriving into Tonga, their first warm-up game against Australia A, I think it was. Yeah, it's the lack of time that these teams have together. And then also too, when they get back to Tonga and Samoa, their facilities, and they're still training on a paddock that's uneven, and these boys, they don't get nutritionists and all that sort of stuff. In the documentary, we see the Samoan boys carrying up buckets full of sand as their weights training. And I mean, there is a gym in the islands, but yeah, they're doing it pretty tough. But it's the main thing for them is they have very limited time together as a team. And when they do get together, they're coming from systems from all around the world. And so there's that time period where they have to adjust to one another's playing style and adjust from different coaches' playing styles and techniques and what have you. So the coaches have a real hard time bringing the boys together and then getting them to gel and adjust. It's pretty tough going, but for sure, I know that they were disappointed, but there were some very, very questionable calls for the Pacific Island nations.
Jeremiah Taumiti, producer of Family, Faith and Footy, speaking to Richard Hewitt. And that's it from Pacific Review. This program was produced on the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I'm Liam Fox. Thanks for listening. And do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from around the Pacific.